Asimov has come to a similar conclusion. He did back surgery for many years and apparently bases his conclusion on observed inconsistencies and the logical fact of neurological pathophysiology that continued compression of a nerve will cause it to stop transmitting pain messages after a short time. The result is numbness. How could the herniation then cause continuing pain? Another highly respected physician and investigator who studied the problem for years, Dr. Alf Nakumsen of Sweden, concluded that the cause of back pain was unknown in the majority of cases, and almost all should be treated non-surgically. My conclusion that most disc herniations are harmless is based on 27 years of treating such patients with a high degree of success, leading to the impression that the extruded material is not hurting anything. It's just there. In recent years, there have been numerous reports in the medical literature of herniated discs in patients with no history of back pain. They were discovered inadvertently on CT or MRI studies done to investigate other parts of the body. In order to document the large number of herniated disc patients that I have treated successfully over many years, a follow-up survey was conducted in 1987. 109 patients were interviewed by telephone by a research assistant. Their names were selected randomly from a large population of patients who were seen and treated from 1 to 3 years previously. In each case, pain was attributed to a herniated disc that could be seen on a CT scan. Based on history and physical examination, the diagnosis was TMS. All went through the usual treatment program. Of the 109 patients, 96, that is 88%, were free or nearly free of pain, and were able to perform unrestricted physical activity. 11 patients, that is 10%, were improved, experienced some pain, and were able to perform restricted activity. Only 2 patients, 2%, were unchanged. The 2 patients who did not improve were found to have severe, persistent psychological problems and continue in psychotherapy to this day. These statistics make it difficult to take the herniated disc seriously. Yet each of these patients had been told that this was the reason for the pain. 39 of them had been advised to have surgery. 3 had already had such surgery. And most of the rest had been told that surgery might be necessary if conservative measures failed. During the years that I have been engaged in this work, I have seen the diagnosis of spinal stenosis emerge as one of the most common when there is low back pain and no herniated disc to blame. It refers to narrowing of the spinal canal, occasionally thought to be congenital, but most often a result of aging in spinal bones. Buildup of bone, in some places called osteophytes, narrows the canal. My reaction to this abnormality is based on experience with patients. Most of those I have seen, regardless of age, were found to have TMS, which allowed me to disregard the X-ray diagnosis. When stenosis is severe, the canal should be widened surgically, but I have seen very few of such cases. It is my practice, particularly with older patients, to suggest neurological consultation so that the possibility of significant impingement on neural structures can be carefully studied. If the neural picture is satisfactory and the patient has the classic findings of TMS, I proceed with confidence regardless of what the X-ray shows. After herniated disc, a pinched nerve is one of the most common diagnoses made. Usually when patients present with pain in the neck, shoulder, and upper limb on the same side. What is presumably being pinched is a cervical spinal nerve as it courses its way through a hole formed by contiguous cervical vertebrae, known as a foramen. And what is supposed to be doing the pinching is an osteophyte, a bone spur, or a herniated disc. The diagnosis is fraught with difficulty. It rests on exceedingly shaky concepts. Once more, the need to identify a structural cause is the problem, and sometimes breeds a disturbing lack of objectivity. The following observations throw doubt on the pinched nerve diagnosis. First, these symptoms often occur in young adults who have no bone spurs and no herniated discs. Second, bone spurs are extremely common, and many people who have them don't have pain. Spurs increase in number and size with advancing age, so that by late middle age and beyond, everyone ought to have neck and arm pain from them, but everyone doesn't. Third, neuroradiologists tell us the spurs would have to obliterate the foramen before compression of the nerve would occur, something one rarely sees. Fourth, the same principle applies here as with the lumbar herniated disc. Persistent compression of a nerve will produce objective numbness or absence of pain on testing. This is different from the subjective sensation of numbness that patients sometimes feel in a leg or arm. Fifth, there are numerous reports in the medical literature of large growths in the spine, like benign tumors, that often produce no pain. Most pinched nerve patients have TMS involving the muscles of the neck and shoulders, particularly the upper trapezius muscle and the cervical spinal nerves, after they have left the spinal bones. Four cervical and the first thoracic spinal nerves form what is known as the brachial plexus, a kind of staging area, where they are then reorganized into the nerves that go into the arm and hand. It is highly likely that the brachial plexus is often implicated in the TMS process. But whether it is the spinal nerves, the brachial plexus, or both is irrelevant, for we do not treat the disorder locally. We work on it where it begins, in the brain. Here is a striking case history that teaches many lessons. The patient was a middle-aged professional woman who developed pain in the left neck, shoulder, and entire left arm, with particularly severe pain in the wrist. She was often awakened at night by the wrist pain. To make matters worse, she realized one day that she had lost almost all movement at the left shoulder, what's known as a frozen shoulder. This is a common complication of shoulder pain. Patients apparently begin to limit movement at the shoulder, probably because of pain, without realizing that they're not moving it, and are suddenly aware that the range of motion is gone. In the absence of normal movement, the capsule of the shoulder joint shrinks, as it will in any joint in which there is restricted movement. Further, she reported that the left hand was weak, and she tended to drop things. Despite the ominous sound of these symptoms, I suspected she had TMS, and the physical examination supported the diagnosis. The patient was receptive to the diagnosis. She was familiar with